from that.
Open the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use. Today is April 16th, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 696. And I'm going to ask Mr. Bovet to tell us about the bill, because we're not sure if we're going to get our Senate friend or not in. He may join you midway through, he may not, but we're counting on you to tell us all about this bill, and it seems to have come out of the Senate strongly, so that's a good sign.
Yes, I promise, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties. As I'm sure the committee's all aware, because you've heard other bills relating to this, Oregon law delegates the obligation and responsibility to counties to regulate and issue permits for outdoor mass gatherings. Part of that permit process is established in county ordinance. Part of it is in state law. One of the pieces that's in state law is the cap on the limit of liability insurance as part of a permit. That was last adjusted and set in 1993 at $1 million. That happened to be the exact number that was in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. So everything is hunky-dory until 2009. And the Oregon Supreme Court told us you can't have static numbers in the Oregon Tort Claim Act. You have to scroll them forward to deal with inflation. Otherwise, you violate the remedies clause. So since 2009, the Oregon Tort Claims Act have been scrolling forward. That $1 million limit from 1993 is now about $1.4 million. So in 2009, we changed the Oregon Tort Claims Act and essentially applied a COLA to the Oregon Tort Claims Act limits, scrolling forward from that date forward. But we forgot about this darn statute in the outdoor mass gathering. So we have not scrolled that $1 million forward to match the Oregon Tort Claims Act. So that's what 696 does. It does what we should have done in 2009 and forgot about. And as I mentioned at the end of my testimony, maybe I'm better late than never. So this is, in my opinion, a technical fix of our outdoor mass gatherings liability statute. Happy to answer any questions you might have. As the chair mentioned, it did come over 30-0, unanimous due pass out of Senate Judiciary as well.
And the Board of Commissioners can also choose not to require insurance if they want to. This is if they choose to require insurance, this would raise the limit that the board may impose.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly correct. Very well said.
Okay. See, didn't need Roblin at all, probably. Any further questions for Rob? All right. Then let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 696. And you okay to wing this one if you got no helpers? Let me open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 287A. We have a long sign-in sheet, too. That's another. Yep, that's right. Okay, tell us all about, what you know about 287A, Senate Bill 287A.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For your record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. Very pleased to be here today on Senate Bill 287A, which comes to you from the State Senate on a 27-3 vote. It is sponsored by a couple of high-profile senators, and I'm here today to say that there's never a senator around when you really need one. But that being the case, let me tell you that this is a measure intended to support small farms and agritourism, and we'd like to do that very simply by providing breweries with the same opportunities that we already provide to wineries and cideries, and that is to come out, take a look at how the product is grown, take a look at how the product is produced, buy it on site, and go home with very favorable impressions and good memories with the intention later on of buying more of it. For all the hard questions, Mr. Chairman, I think there's a long list of people signed up that would be anxious to answer those questions for you.
I think you're right. Anything for our colleague? Okay, we'll move on the list. Dave Honeycutt, is it Matt Merritt? M. Mark Merritt, I believe, maybe. And Matt, sorry. And Eric Brown. And Representative Bossart Davis.
Just a comment.
Comment.
And I was looking it up, and
Did Representative leave? I was just going to note, I think he said 27-3. It was actually 27-0, so it was unanimous, but three were excused, and I think that that matters.
That's helpful.
So just FYI.
Yes, that's helpful. Thank you. Okay, who's going to start us off?
I will start us off. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Property Owners Association here in support of Senate Bill 287A. Next to me is Matt Merritt, who is general counsel for Rogue Ales. To Matt's right is Eric Brown, who operates Rogue's 52-acre farm in Polk County, where they raise the or where they grow the hops and other other crops that they use in the various beers that are ales that Rogue
and where made. The House Ag Committee had its committee party last year when session ended.
There you go, Mr. Chair.
FYI.
So essentially, as I said on the Senate side,
I'm the only person on here from last time.
Oh.
Sorry, I don't know if anybody was even on here. No. I think Representative Brocksmith might have been. He was at the party. Anyway, sorry. Yes, about the bill. I'm still remembering fondly the nice spring day at the
Absolutely.
Brewery.
This bill really just makes an effort to mimic the wineries and cidery statutes that have passed over the years, except instead of grapes or fruit, this applies to hops. If you compare this to the wineries and cideries bill, essentially you'll see the same thing, the same standards, the same kind of uses, and the same essential limitations. The bill limits the companies or the property owners that can use this bill to brewers that are small in nature, 150,000 barrels or less total from the brewer, and 15,000 barrels or less on the farm. It requires a 15 acres hops, and so it has limitations on both the amount that can be produced on site and also the amount that can be produced by the brewer as a whole in wherever they're brewing. So we made amendments to the bill over on the Senate side, worked with Thousand Friends and the Farm Bureau and DLCD on the Senate side. That's what you see in the A and Gross version. And as Representative Bossart Davis pointed out, and I'm glad she did, I was going to make the same point. The bill came out on the Senate side with a 27-0 vote. So. Be happy to answer any questions, but Eric, at the end, is really the one that you want to ask questions about from, not Matt and I. We're just boring lawyers, and he's interesting. So, with that, be happy to answer any questions, or we can forward to Mr. Merritt.
Questions for Dave? Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm just another boring lawyer here. I'll say a couple of things and we'll hand it off to Eric, who you really want to hear from. 287A simply gives farm breweries.
I really need your boring lawyer name.
Oh, my boring lawyer name is Matthew Merritt. Sorry, I'm a general counsel at Rogue Ales, Merritt. 287A just gives farm breweries the same land use rights that the legislature has already given to wineries and cideries. In 2013, Senate Bill 841 gave wineries the ability to conduct limited agritourism events on their wineries. And then in 2017, Senate Bill 677 gave cider makers the same land use rights that wine had previously gotten. Both of those bills passed unanimously. With 287A, we're simply asking that you now do the same for breweries. That's it. Just like the wine and cider bills before it, 287A would allow farm breweries like Rogue to conduct 18 agritourism events per calendar year, subject to some local permitting process that includes controls around traffic, sanitation, things like that. 287A is modeled exactly after 677, the cider bill from 2 years ago. Anywhere 677 said cider, this says beer, things like that. So other than changes in the bill to have it reflect the practical differences between wine and cider and beer, it's the same bill. Like the wine and cider bills, and like Dave mentioned, there's an acreage minimum in 287A, and that minimum is 15 acres. Other ingredients besides hops can be counted towards that acreage minimum, and that's because unlike wine and cider with beer, there can be other ingredients really that go into the beer. And Eric will tell you about some of those that we have at Rogue Farms. There's also, as Dave mentioned, an on-site production cap of 15,000 barrels. 15,000 barrels is the Brewers Association definition of a microbrewery. So the 15,000 number ensures that there's not going to be major brewing operations taking place on-site. I'm here speaking for Rogue, but I do want to point out the bill is supported by the Oregon Brewers Guild, who I believe is here today, supported as well. The last thing I'll say is that in passing the wine and cider bills before this bill, the legislature has already really figured out the balance between commercial uses and agricultural uses in this setting. And all we're asking is that you give the beer industry what you've already given to the wine and the cider industries. And so with that, I'll pass it over to Eric from Rogue Farms, unless there's any questions.
I do need to ask one question. How many gallons are in a barrel?
31.
So the only thing I'm trying to sort out here is when I look up the cider statute, it references gallons, and like the production limits are gallons, and here we're using barrels, and it's 100,000 gallons versus, I don't know if it's 15,000 or 150 that would be the apple, sorry, I don't mean to make a pun, but the apples to apples, sorry, comparison between gallons, because if we're trying to stay the same with cider, I'm just trying to figure out why we would be 31 times the number of barrels that is the limit and 100,000 gallons in the cider, and I don't know what criteria we used, if we used bottles or cases or what we used in wineries.
I'm not entirely sure why those numbers were set where they were for wine and cider, but I can say that certainly in the beer industry, barrelage is the measure. And you know the ingredients that go in to the beer that's produced, I think the ratios are different. And so we've taken steps, like I said, with the microbrewery definition, which is just 15,000 barrels, which is pretty small, to keep this at a limited scope relative to the acreage. And so we think, despite the fact that there's gallons are used in the prior statutes, the fit between the acreage minimum and the production cap is a solid fit here.
Can I take a stab at answering that, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair?
Like if I'm doing my math right, we're talking like 4.6 million gallons would be allowed versus 100,000.
I don't think it's that much, but what the winery and cidery bills did was they tied the amount produced to the amount of acreage. So if you have an acre of grapes, you should produce X amount of bottles of wine, and if you have an acre of apples, you should produce X amount of cider. The 15 acre limitation in this bill, with 15 acres of hops, you should be able to produce, actually it's a little less, it's a little less or a little more, but it's right on the number of 15,000 barrels. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was we were using the same ratios that they have for wine and cider and just trying to limit the amount of beer produced to the amount of hops that needed to be grown so that they matched.
That would roughly come off that same number of acres.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. Okay, that's helpful. Sorry, the most interesting man in the world hasn't got a chance to talk yet because we're asking questions, please.
You're in for a treat. Okay. Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Eric Brown. I'm the Assistant Director of Operations here at Rogue. Very pleased to be speaking with you today. I manage the farm down in Independence, whereas you've heard we have about 52 acres of farmland. Senate Bill 287 is important to us and breweries like ours because it ensures that we'll be able to showcase the connection between farming and brewing, which is a really important part of our business. We invite our customers to come visit the farm to see where and how beer ingredients are grown. The Willamette Valley is an ideal spot for growing hops, and that's a crucial part of beer, of course. Visitors can see the hops on the vine. They can be right there in the middle of the harvest when it's in progress, and they can learn about the brewing process from our staff. We also have a garden at Rogue Farms, where we have 50 herbs, vegetables, and fruits or so. And our development team uses those to experiment with new flavors and to come up with new ideas for recipes. Let's see, we got our first small harvest of cherries recently. We may get some kiwis this spring. We have a couple types of raspberries. We've got strawberries and rhubarb. We use all these in beer. Every year we bring our staff down from Portland to harvest pumpkins, which we use in our fall seasonal pumpkin patch ale. And we have a uniquely Oregon berry, the Marion berry, which we make Marion berry sour. We have an acre of those. So we grow all these to use in beer, but we also do it to learn about farming and so that we can be better brewers, is the idea. So this bill is very valuable to us. It'll guarantee that we can continue to educate our customers in how we choose and how we source ingredients, as well as educate people on how Oregon agriculture plays a role in our success. So I urge you to support this bill, and thank you for taking the time to hear my thoughts.
Question, Vice Chair McClain.
So you sound, that sounds intriguing, and I don't like beer, but I do like the smell of hops and all those other things that you were going to put in it I like. But this is, and it's all because of my good friend here who had a cider bill on our side, and it matters to me a lot on how we have the base bill, because you guys would be the base bill, you guys would be the first ones, you know, to bring this and use it. And then there are going to be all kinds of other people trying to figure out how to use it and how they want to change it. So like the operation, the cider operation that this fellow has was much smaller than what our base bill was. So I think we really have to understand the acreage issue and the gallons or barrels or, you know, measurement issues so that we know this is a reasonable amount. And I tried to follow what you said about converting acres to barrels and how many acres you needed to make that many barrels. And I don't know if that's backwards or not. It seems like we should care about how big the place is, and that might be on barrels or capacity of this agro-tourism that you're trying to use, and mm-hmm. I totally support that. So I guess, Mr. Chair, you had some really good beginning questions. I don't know how to talk about them because I don't know enough about your operation or why you use those particular numbers. You know, I mean, you have 52 acres, you have other vegetables and other ingredients and things of that nature. So I guess I want to understand more and I can read more. So I'll go back and look at the materials that are on OLIS. But thank you.
You're very welcome.
I would, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair McClain, I would point out that the concept behind this bill, along with the other two bills, is to ensure that only what's being produced, the farm crop that's being produced at the farm brewery site is what's used.
Okay.
That nothing else. You don't need to bring other bring crops in from other farms or other locations in order to produce.
Oh, that's now. See, look at that nice filter that you put there.
That's the idea, okay. To match up the amount of hops grown with the amount of beer on site with the amount of beer produced on site.
Okay. Oh, that helps. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm curious about that because my understanding is we don't grow any domestic barley here in the United States anymore. So it might work for hops, but I'm kind of curious about how many semi-loads of barley are you going to bring in and how many thousands of gallons of water are you going to need and how are you going to get it?
Well, I can take a stab at that. We do source our malt, you know, which is made from barley from the Pacific Northwest for the most part. So, you know, as for the amount of barley used in each batch of beer or so on, that I would need to look into to get you exact numbers. But We have grown barley before. We don't right now, but we did at one point in Thai Valley, and. Mm-hmm. I guess I couldn't speak to exactly, you know, how much you would have to bring in to be able to brew on site.
If I follow up, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. On the water, it's an awful lot of water. You can't use a domestic well to do it, so you're going to need one with the water right. Are you going to use groundwater? What do you think most people will use, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, so our main brewing facility is in Newport, and so it is in Newport, Oregon, and we do use city water there for that. And it's a little out of my depth, I guess, but we do work very closely with that public utility to make sure that, you know, our rate schedule is appropriate for our size, and that we're treating their system appropriately for the, you know, for the water that we use.
Follow up. So, my understanding, so Dave, you might have to help me here. So we want to showcase craft brewing on EFU land, and for wineries and cideries, we're making it there, and we're using some of the crops that they grow. So, how does the beer actually get to your place on EFU land? I'm trying to understand this from what I know of wineries, which is they take it out of the tank and they take it over to, mostly, for the most part, the tasting room.
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, I will get you, you've asked a question that the three of us haven't talked about. I will get you an answer. And either come back and deliver it to the committee or speak to you directly about it. I understand your question, and I just don't know the answer for this particular, for Rogue, but I'll get an answer and bring it back to you.
Thank you. I would appreciate that.
Okay, any other questions? Rep. Bossart Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I find it interesting, you know, there was a bill for the wineries, and then there was another bill for the cideries, and then now another bill for brewers. I'm wondering if in next session, potato farmers are going to come to us, and barley farmers, and wheat farmers, and those are the ones I quickly listed, as to them being able to do the same thing. And so I don't know if that's... I agree with all of those. I'm just wondering, do we need a different bill for each one of these products that are trying to do the same thing? I think that the question on the acreage and the ratio to whether it's gallons or barrels is obviously something that would have to be determinate based on the crop. But it's interesting to think, are we going to have a separate bill for every single crop that could provide a tasting room on EFU ground? And I don't know if that's really a question that you guys can answer, but I do know that I had a constituent reach out to me on this issue and said, well, what about barley farmers and what about wheat farmers? And maybe that's a different bill. I don't know, but it's something that maybe we could talk about.
Yeah, I'm reaching back into my memory banks here. When we did the winery, when we did the, what was that thing called? Senate Bill 586, I think. It was I don't remember when it was. It was quite a long time ago, but the number sticks in my head. And it was about ag tourism and events at anything but winery-related venues, I guess I would call them. Could be, they weren't tasting rooms. I guess just farms. Mm-hmm. It was on-farm events. And I really wanted to push that all these events would be and all these activities would be regulated regardless of crop type. And the wineries were very strongly opposed because they had built their own chapter over the years and they wanted to keep what they had and let the farmers have a parallel thing but never just combine it. And I still never thought that was the best idea, but I lost to Representative Holvey, I think it was at the time. And so I have in several cases wondered the same thing, whether it wouldn't be better to have a consistent policy. But Now that we've said that, I'm sure someone from the wine lobby will show up here pretty soon and say, no, don't touch ours. Don't treat us all the same. But you have a point. There are other ingredients in these things that that may show up at some point. And we'll just have to keep processing this. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to apologize for my assertion about production of barley. It does seem that Oregon does produce barley. I must have been conflating that with oats. And it looks like from the... Yeah. I'm not dissing. Looks like we have about 26,000 acres of barley going in the state as of 2018. So I apologize for that misinformation.
Okay. Any further questions for this group right at the moment? All right. Let me call up some more folks. We've got Patrick Levy, Samantha Bayer, and Michael. I'm sorry, Michelle Palacios. How about Patrick?
Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Pat Levy. I have grown hops commercially on our family farm in the Willamette Valley for 41 years, and I support farm-based brewing. Under current land use laws, it is allowed on exclusive farm use land as a use in conjunction with hop farming. There are approved farm breweries on EFU land right now. Senate Bill 287 sets new standards for the establishment of farm breweries. It sets a minimum acreage necessary to qualify for a brewery, and it sets a maximum barrelage to regulate the size of the facility. Understandably, both standards regulate and limit the activity on EFU land. There is one standard in the bill which does not regulate the activity, but regulates who may establish a brewery. The bill prohibits an entity from establishing a farm brewery if that entity produces 150,000 barrels or more of malt beverage anywhere on earth. This limitation has nothing to do with farm use. There is no explanation as to why it's important. It is just plain over legislating. The bill should regulate what, not who. There's no difference between an entity in this world producing 149,999 barrels and one that is producing 150,000 barrels. I respectfully ask that the limitation on who may establish a farm brewery be removed from the law. Thank you for your time, and I would answer any question.
Let's go ahead and finish our panel. So, Samantha? Okay.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Samantha Bayer, Associate Policy Counsel with the Oregon Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau believes that it is only fair and makes sense that farm breweries are treated the same as wineries and cideries. And although we share a lot of the similar concerns that were just addressed by Representative Bosshart Davis, we worked with proponents on the acreage minimums and feel fairly comfortable that the 15 minimum acres will ensure that, at least with this bill and the farm breweries, that these will be farm first operations. So we are neutral on this bill as written. Thank you.
Michelle.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Post, Vice Chair McLean, and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Palacios, and I serve as the Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon Hop Growers Association. And thank you for the opportunity to provide comment today. Our association's headquartered in Hubbard, Oregon, and I'm providing testimony on behalf of commercial hop growers in this state. Hops are grown in Marion and Polk County, as well as some small acreage farms in southern and central Oregon, with a total acreage of just under 8,000 acres. Hops have been grown in Oregon since the late 1800s, and it's an industry rich with history and a legacy, as most of today's producers are fourth or fifth generation hop growers. We are providing testimony today in support of the legislation that would promote Oregon's hop industry through the establishment of breweries on Oregon hop farms. In my submitted testimony, I did provide some facts and figures about the Oregon hop industry, including that our 2017 farm gate value was $59.6 million, and that ranks us as the 15th largest among Oregon's agricultural commodities. Oregon hops are used domestically and internationally, and we ship to more than 65 countries around the world. We supply hops to Oregon's thriving beer industry, supporting 281 breweries in our state, and we rank third in our nation in hop production. The Oregon hop industry has a story to tell, which resonates with today's savvy consumer. Our region's rich soil, mild climate, and abundant rainfall provide ideal conditions for producing high-quality aroma-type hops. On-farm breweries increase our opportunity to connect with consumers to the products they purchase and to share the important contributions our industry makes to the state of Oregon. Hop growers are recognized for being conservation-minded, with many growers participating in best practices programs, certification programs such as Salmon Safe and Global Gap. And this is a positive message that we believe is meant to be shared. Oregon has a thriving agritourism industry, and the concept behind Senate Bill 287 would allow for hop growers in this state to have an additional attraction to bring visitors to the farms. And as well, farm breweries would have the added crossover with culinary tourism. Thank you for your willingness to support the Oregon hop industry with this legislation, and we look forward to working with you as the bill moves forward. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair McLean.
Sir, your comment about the 149,000 versus 150,000. So your point, do you think that that number has meaning, or do you think that number is too big or too small, or you just don't like government saying this is the number?
I don't like having a number. And I'm not to where I don't like government saying things. Uh-huh. So that's not it. Mm-hmm. I just don't see a reason why we're saying, like I say, who can do something. We have model airplane, permitted on EFU land. We have one next to us. They're not the most pleasant thing, but it's what was decided because there's no place to do it.
Yeah.
But the law doesn't say it can't be used by people who have more than five model airplanes. In other words, I just don't see where it applies.
Can't hit. So I think my follow-up on that is that what I was trying to get at with the acreage amount and with the gallons or barrels or whatever is that there is capacity. And Representative Helm started talking about resource capacity, and I was talking about capacity. We've had other bills this session talking about capacity on this type of thing, and where was the parking, and you know, where was the space, and right. And how could you control the needs, you know, to have, you know, appropriate, you know, services.
Okay.
And so I was trying to find out if you actually had a number or had.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm not doing a very good job here. I'm not talking about the number for the facility on the land.
Okay.
I think that number that has been talked about, the 15,000 barrels, is adequate, I'll guarantee you, for a brewery.
Okay.
I'm talking about. That's fine. I'm saying that you're saying if I brew a million barrels in downtown Portland and I want to have a farm brewery, this law prohibits me doing that because the 150,000 barrel numbers if you read the, is saying it doesn't matter where they're brewed. You can't do this. And I, there's no need, it'd be easy to find names of people who you're prohibiting, but it's, and I'm not usually, I'm the smallest hop grower. Michelle knows me for she knows how small, I usually don't defend big. Okay. I'm small. Mm-hmm. But this is saying that large people can't do this. And you've already regulated the acreage. You've regulated how big the facility can be. And I agree, parking, all those issues. You're just saying, hey, big people can't do this.
Okay, I'm not, but I
the bill is.
The bill is. But okay, so thank you. And now I understand what you were getting at.
Yeah, I just was rereading the both cider and winery statutes to see if there's any equivalent standard, and there isn't.
There is.
It's about that particular winery can, you know, make less than 50,000 gallons of wine and has to have 15 acres. If it's over 50,000 gallons at that particular winery, then it's 40 acres. That they need to make, and then in the cider statute, I forgot what it was already, 100,000 gallons, and I forgot the acreage, 15 acres or 100,000 gallons on 40. So that whole 150,000 upper limit is not borrowed from those. It's just a cottage industry kind of law
it's a
or something. Yeah,
or
philosophy.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Any Representative Post or Vice Chair Post?
Thank you. So maybe I should have asked the previous panel then, because this panel has gotten me confused. I'm looking, not the whole panel, sorry. Some, everybody. I'm looking at a website right now of a place that's in my district, Sodbuster Farms. You know them, Doug and Audrey, right? I know Doug and Audrey well. And maybe correct me if I, maybe you'd be the best person to ask Michelle.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Michelle?
Michelle, we're correct, yes.
Don't they currently have sort of a kind of thing like the Rogue situation? If I remember right, he has a little place to drink beer there.
So, right, he does. He has a set of taps in his office, has a very nice welcome center for folks to visit the farm. He's not currently brewing, though. To my knowledge, we do though have a farm currently that is brewing on farm in addition to the previous panel that used the conditional use permit to place the brewery on EFU land. So Sodbuster, we're just using them as an example. He is currently serving beer, but not beer that it's beer that his hops may be in, but not he's not currently brewing the beer on his farm, but he's serving beer that has his hops as an ingredient.
Follow up.
Did I just throw?
And I'm just getting quoted.
Did I just throw the Weathers under the
bus? Doug might correct me.
Did I just throw the Weathers under the bus? Are they doing? I mean,
and also, I should clarify that Doug's is purely. Goodwill, you know, it's he's serving it as to his guests, but not he's not generating income.
Okay.
It's not a business. Yeah.
Thank you. That was what I was looking for because I've been to your place as well. Isn't it the windy road out from Independence? And, yeah. And that's set up where there's something to eat and drink and so on and so forth.
Doug is currently a production farm that has a very nice conference room.
So this bill. Limit or not limit Doug if he wanted to go to this round.
This bill limit Doug?
Or not, I mean, could he
poor
expand?
Poor Doug, wish Doug was here.
I know, he's going to kill me, he really is.
So currently, as Pat Levy had mentioned, as the law currently is, hop farmers can place farms using conditional use permits currently on EFU land.
Okay,
so this bill further defines that to have a brewery, you need to be growing hops. If you want to place a brewery on EFU land, it's clarifying that you need to have 15 acres of ag production. I don't think it actually says 15 acres of hops, but 15 acres of ag production.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so last question would be then, if I'm reading you right, Pat, and I am going to use a name because it helps me understand better. If Pabst Blue Ribbon from Milwaukee, Wisconsin decides to open up a little farm in the Willamette Valley, that's what you're getting at. You're saying Pabst could never do that.
Correct.
Under this bill. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Bossart Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm along the same line as Vice Chair Post. If it's happening, what problem are we trying to solve?
I just think we should have the author of the bill. The Oregon Hop Growers Association took a position because we want to support legislation that continues to allow on-farm brewing operations to occur. What this does is it does define that there needs to be production happening in order for there to justify the brewery being placed there. Now, currently, our commercial hop growers that have the breweries, the one or two that do, certainly are already meeting that criteria. But this legislation, as I understand it, or correct me, Pat, defines that in legislation that there needs to be ag production, that we can't simply place a brewery on EFU land without there being ag production. Yeah.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So do you know of any hop producers, maybe that's wrong, do you know of anyone that would not benefit from this bill if passed? Would we hurt anything that's going on now that's legally being done, that if this bill passes, then makes their on-farm brewery now illegal?
No. Not that I'm aware of, no. And we have about 25 families in Oregon that grow hops. Okay.
So for instance,
follow up.
For instance, there wouldn't be one that had 12 contiguous acres instead of 15 or something along those lines that then wouldn't. I'm just concerned about somebody that's invested in something already that would then be made illegal if it's already happening with this bill is my concern.
There are certainly hop growers of varying sizes, commercial hop growers. When I say commercial, we define it nationally as a quarter acre. Okay. But commercially in practice is if they are hitting the merchant network and their hops are hitting that that use channel. So that acreage varies between 50 to 1,000 acres. Mm-hmm. But our average hop farm in Oregon is about 2 to 250 acres. Mm-hmm. But we certainly do have, as I mentioned in my testimony, there are small acreage farms in Central Oregon, Deschutes County and Southern Oregon that would probably fall below those 15 acres. But I don't know necessarily if they have plans for on-farm breweries that this 15 acres of production would harm them. I can't say for certain.
Okay, thank you.
I don't.
Well, let's just try something with this panel. If there were a bill to allow wheat growers into this exact same thing, would the Farm Bureau or the Hop Growing Association or the hop farmers support that bill or oppose it? Or
canned potatoes and barley?
Anything else that's an ingredient of beer that's a crop and owns at least 15 acres of that contiguously?
So for beer, you're not talking about distilleries? Is that?
Yeah, like potatoes.
I was just going to stick with beer for the moment. There isn't a potato beer as far as I know, but there's definitely wheat in beer because I sneeze.
There's chocolate beer.
Like, are we going to have a fight later where the hops people say, look, we're the most important part of beer, not them?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, the Farm Bureau is obviously, there's a lot of our membership who is concerned about what's the next thing to come and the next thing to come to be cited on EFU zone land. Our biggest issue and our initial issue with this bill is it has to be farm first. It has to be about agricultural production. This needs to be a working farm. And at least within the sideboards of this bill, we can see that. So any bill in the future, we would have to see those same type of sideboards and those same type of conditions on the operation to ensure that it's not going to interfere with any farm practices or with the farming community.
Okay, thank you. And let's get to an actual opponent. We've got some neutrals, but Catherine Jernstead. And then after that, we'll have Jackson Coleman and Jonathan. Actually, Jonathan and Jackson, you can join her as well. I don't know if there is a Jackson here or not. No Jackson, Coleman. Okay, Catherine.
My name is Catherine Jernstead. I'm the president of Friends of Yamhill County. I'm also a resident on the Jernstead Century Farm in Yamhill County. My great-grandfather tried hops in the late 1800s, and basically they didn't thrive in dryland farming and they were labor intense. So that's why you'll find them further downstate. But if you go into the Golden Valley Brew Pub, among the pictures on the wall is one of the Jernstead hop yards at harvest. So again, Chairman Clem, representatives, I do this with some trepidation as the Senate committee called themselves the Microbrew Caucus. You guys obviously have some of you have history with the breweries, but I'm not anti-beer. Friends is not anti-beer. What we are concerned about is the continuing chipping away of the protections of exclusive farm use land, high-value farm lands for farm use. And farm use is, in fact, defined in our statutes as the growing of crops, raising of livestock, orcharding, fairly extensive lists, for the express purpose of making money with the farm production. It's not choosing a pretty place for its tourism potential. It's supposed to be developing its agricultural use and potential. And whether you consider it a maxim or a cliche, Oregon's land use system is at risk of death by a thousand cuts. We are now up over 50 permitted non-farm uses in exclusive farm use zones. And when you talk about what's coming next, I would not presume to know what it's going to be, but I am relatively confident it's going to be something out there. Things like the bill to reduce the acreage for the cideries. This is an ongoing concerted effort to remove agriculture from agritourism. As the Farm Bureau's representative said, agritourism is supposed to be farm and agricultural centric. You mentioned someone who has the taps and a real nice conference center. That sounds like an event center, and if he's in EFU land, that raises some questions. Representative Vice Chair McLean, you mentioned the sideboards and what the rogue people described as being really an interesting and probably ideal example. But what happens is then the push. The little bit here, the little bit there. Mr. Honeycutt made mention of the winery bill. The wineries were supposed to be processing grapes produced on the property. Yamhill County is approving wineries and tasting rooms without grapes on the property. So conditional use, and there's all kinds of safety valves or loopholes, depending on your perspective, in how our exclusive farm use lands are or are not being protected. I know we can't write a rule for everything. There have got to be provisions for conditional uses and exceptions, but they're becoming the norm. I find the discussion about the total production limit to keep PAPs out of these little special venues. Our wine industry is discovering that they maybe needed to have done something like that too, in that a shocking amount of Yamhill County vineyards are not in local ownership or control. They're not even in U.S. ownership or control. So we start down a path. The pioneers had a beautiful vision. They did a great deal to energize that county. But they're now in a position to have to vigorously defend their reputation and the quality of their product. As these things grow and expand, the unintended consequences can be significant. And as someone who lives in a neighborhood of these activities, it is not nearly the idyllic vision that some of us thought it was going to be, that some of us thought we were looking at. Regarding the questions about water and capacity, I was doing a little online stuff and came across an issue of The Growler, a industry trade magazine. The article is entitled "The Thirsty Business of Beer: How Breweries Are Confronting the Industry's Water Problem." Much of the article is a cautionary tale about California water issues. But it is interesting to note that beer is 90 to 95% water. Water is used in every step of the brewing process. Only a small amount actually makes it into the package. Inside the average brew house, it takes 7 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of beer. At less efficient breweries, the ratio can go as high as 10 to 1. Cleaning uses most water, 3 to 8 gallons per gallon of beer. And additional water is needed for cooling and packaging. I did the numbers, 15,000 barrels at 31 gallons to a barrel is 465,000 gallons of beer. At the average, 7 gallons of water per gallon of beer, we're talking 3,255,000 gallons of water. That doesn't include other events like the bed and breakfast or food service or other commercial activities that the legislation permits. Another issue, brewhouse is not the only place where water comes into play. In fact, when the water used to grow the agricultural ingredients needed to make the beers factored in, the aforementioned water-to-beer ratio can increase nearly tenfold. Again, they cite some numbers about AB InBev, one of the big-time players. It reports that 90% of its water input comes from water used for agriculture. Barley needs 15 to 17 inches of water throughout its growing cycle. And again, some parts of the state get it, some years, others not. So that's potentially. Water application for some hop varieties can exceed 50 to 60 inches annually. Again, why a lot of our hop yards are there along the rivers with people with historic water rights. Then we go back to the wastewater issue. Wastewater disposal is another concern. In small municipalities, the volume of brewery effluent can overwhelm sewer and water treatment capacities. Brow Brothers Brewing Company moved to Marshall, Minnesota from its original home in Lucan for this very reason. Again, they're having to move based on this. Additionally, brewer wastewater can be too high in particulates and have an improper pH for treatment facilities to handle. This forces breweries to either pre-treat their water or pay stiff surcharges, both expensive propositions. The wine industry's discharge water has a pH that is adverse to septic systems, and they don't have the degree of particulates even that a beer discharge will have. So, however kindly and gracious what's envisioned, The fact is, it's going to be a huge water consumer. There are going to be issues with wastewater disposal, which I don't know if our county sanitarians understand the difference between this and the common household discharge. I happen to live quite a ways from Many River and in a very water-limited area. Our county has decided they don't have the jurisdiction to make water restrictions, so we're wondering how long before all of us have wells go dry, not just some of us. The science on groundwater is very spotty, not well understood. It's not like our river flows where they've got staff gauges out there and a state agency responsible for going out and measuring. So we don't know what we don't know yet, even about groundwater, beyond the fact that it is not an unlimited resource. So the implications for near neighbors in these kind of water intense uses is very concerning. Members of my own family and adjacent properties have had wells go dry. Neighbors in the community have them go dry. Just down across the road, they ended up in salt water before they struck water. So these are complex and lifetime issues for longtime residents of these agricultural communities. Burying work, this activity really needs the services of an urban setting. And I would encourage you to understand the distinction. Hops are not to beer what grapes are to wine or apples to cider. They are a flavoring ingredient. The bill allows for grain growing and some of that sort of activity. But the reality is, it's not a product of the fruit grown on the property in the manner equivalent to cideries or wineries. Again, various bills trying to take agriculture out of agritourism, the pressure for event centers, wedding venues, all of these other activities to subsidize the expense of the farm operation is backwards. If you select your property and your crop to align with each other, not buy something for its view or tourist potential and take it out of production or diminish its production as a farm. Agriculture is the number two industry in Oregon. 1 in 8 jobs are in agriculture. That deserves our respect. So, thank you.
Jonathan.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton, here today on behalf of the Oregon Brewers Guild. Oregon's craft brewers directly employ 9,453 people in Oregon with wages that are twice the national average. And I don't really have anything to add to the conversation today. We just wanted to show up to lend our support to our friends at Rogue. And so thanks, and just ask you to support this bill.
Questions for this panel?
Well, I don't know if I... I don't know if I have a question, but I really appreciate your thorough conversation and the information that you bring, and also the respect that you have for the agricultural, industry here in the state. And I really remember when there were presentations like this on wineries, starting up with tasting rooms, and so I'm trying to think through all of that. Because, again, I think even on folks like guest ranches, we made an effort, and I only voted for it this time because we made an effort that said that the farm has to be primary. And so, this bill or any other bill that gets my vote, the farm has to be primary. And that's what I'm thinking about when you're giving us your information, because there's a difference between, I think, having other activities and still having the primary activity be farming. And I don't know if that's true in this case. I haven't read this bill well enough yet. It's, we're just switching over to Senate bills. But I think it's important for us to look at what you said as a really good base foundation for making sure that these types of bills do keep agriculture primary. And I will work to do that.
I would add one comment that I have my litany of things. I seem to always leave one of them out. Imagine what this level of investment could do for some of our still depressed rural communities. How many of our small rural towns have empty storefronts and could really benefit from a food and entertainment venue in their midst? It could make all the difference in the world for some of these small towns.
Okay, further questions? All right, thank you very much for coming down. Let me, and did we ever find Jackson Coleman? No. Okay, then I'm gonna close the public hearing on Senate Bill 287A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 408A and ask our colleagues to join us. And we're calling up your Carla McLean as well.
Hi.
Representative, Senator, who would like to begin?
I will go first hand. Honorable Chair Clem and esteemed committee members, my name is James Ivory Manning Jr. I am the senator from District 7, which I can say here is the best Senate district in the state. I don't have any other senators in the room, so I'll go along with that. So I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 408A. And this bill passed the Senate floor on unanimous. You know, we on the Senate side felt that this is a really good bill. As a former Eugene Water and Electric Board Commissioner, I understand the importance of how we treat customers in the utility industry. This bill came up in 2017, I believe, and it was because of some issues that I had with it, unclear as to non-use or use of certain parts of farmland. I wanted to make sure that we keep farmland intact. What this bill does, it allows the counties to make a determination whether there are usable, unusable parts of farmland that could be used to help the public utility industry and stuff to expand and give more support, more services to our communities, especially in our rural communities. My district is urban and rural, so this is really important to me. EWEB supports this bill, and certainly I'm here in support of this bill as well, so I urge your support as well.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Clem. It is true this bill has passed the Senate unanimously. I'd ask that you overlook that and still give it strong consideration. And for the record, I'm Representative Greg Smith. I appreciate my friend, Chair Manning. So just very quickly, colleagues, Senator Manning did a very good job teeing this issue up. You know, it's not every day that we have the Farm Bureau and Thousand Friends and special districts and our electric cooperatives all coming together to find a solution to preserve farm ground and to make sure that folks who need power can get the power that they need. But that's exactly what Senate Bill 408A does. Very, very briefly, Senate Bill 408A gives county planners a new tool to subdivide EFU property for utility facilities necessary for public use, for example, substations, water towers, et cetera. It does not expand the authority for new uses of EFU. And we would ask for your strong consideration on this legislation. Thank you.
Any questions for our colleagues? What are you doing over there? Representative Helm.
Thank you for bringing the bill to us. I think one of the things that makes sense to me is the conundrum that we have put some of our utilities in trying to nail down these places for facilities and having to purchase bigger pieces of property that they don't want to use fully, and then trying to figure out how we keep the rest of them in agricultural use or something. So I think this makes sense. And Representative Smith, I just wanted to compliment you on your tie. It's a really attractive tie. I think it shows how much style you have.
Wandering. Brock Smith. What about your tie? What is it? Who's that?
This is one of the Eskimo ties. This is Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, thank you.
So I just also have to compliment you. Have two of the best dressed legislators.
That's true.
I've learned from the senator.
Yes, thank you.
Appreciate that. That means that our bill will pass, right? So,
it's trending well.
Yeah.
So, just to clarify, did we pass a version of this bill last session? Did you reference it? There was something going before, and then you had some concerns with it.
Mr. Chair, it was on the Senate side. You know, I was concerned about expanding into other areas of farmland. Yeah, so, yeah. But with the Dash 2 amendment, it clearly specifies that any other land zoning will be prohibited, such as looking at retail, commercial, or industry and stuff. All those will be prohibited.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Great. Thank you, gentlemen.
Appreciate you, Chair.
Let me call Ted Case and Alex Schiebel up. And then, Carla, are you there?
I am.
Maybe. Muted, possibly, but there. Carla McLean.
I'm here.
Hello.
Hello.
Carla, do you want to go first or wait for Ted to lead us off here?
I'll wait.
Okay. Ted Case.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Post, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Represent 18 electric co-ops in the state and some of the most rural and remote parts of the state. The hour is nigh. I'm going to be mercifully brief just to say that Oregon's 18 electric co-ops do support Senate Bill 408A. I will note that this has been a really atrocious winter for the electric utility industry in rural Oregon with the storms, and it just gets us reflecting about the importance of utility infrastructure, the importance of having that infrastructure in the right spot, and why this bill would not have kept the lights on for all the folks that we lost power in and certainly around the Eugene and Roseburg area. It does sort of give an extra tool in the toolbox for utility planners for things like substations. So it's a good bill. You're going to hear a lot about the situation in Morrill County where this sort of emanated from. But as Senator Manning said, this is an issue around Eugene. This is an issue in the Hood River area for Hood River Electric Co-op. So it is a really, it's a statewide bill. It's a statewide problem. And we strongly support it. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Okay.
Alex Schiebel, Umatilla Electric Co-op, Government Affairs. We are a cooperative, member-owned service territory west of Boardman and Morrill County, much of Umatilla County up into the Blue Mountains. Thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of Senate Bill 408. I will briefly just say this is fixing a gap right now that when UEC had a substation out in Morrill County, you'll hear from Carla from Morrill County that she thought that there was a mechanism in statute or rule to fix it and subdivide on EFU a smaller footprint. Well, it turned out that statutes, while they allow dog kennels to schools to transmission lines to subdivide, there wasn't anything for utility facilities necessary for public use. As Representative Helm pointed out, you know, it's a issue because the utility could either lease that property from the landowner, and that what the problem there is it retains that underlying liability of the landowner owning the dirt under a substation. Alternatively, a utility could go out and purchase adjacent property, taking more out of production. So this is really kind of a real nip of trying to create a smaller footprint. On the Senate side, we did work with Farm and Thousand Friends and addressed a concern in the Dash 1 that was the sub A in this amendment, which essentially says if at some point that infrastructure gets removed in the future, you can't then use that as some kind of getting a different zone. So it sort of reverts it back to the EFU and protects it. So we worked that out. On the House side, there is a dash two amendment that I'll address. Irene Gilbert, who's an advocate, pointed out in opposition a legislative cleanup that none of us saw in the underlying bill because, frankly, it doesn't impact the substance that we're trying to do. So we assisted her with working with legislative counsel. And so the dash two, which is before you as well, is to restore it at least rather than what's currently in more than. And I would defer to the written testimony for the explanation why, but in checking with legislative counsel, they didn't see a substantive impact of that change. So I would urge your support of Senate Bill 408 along with that amendment, the dash two. And turn it over to Carla and take questions later.
Okay, and Carla, your turn.
Thank you, Chair Clem, Vice Chairs McLean, and Post, and committee members. Carla McLean, I'm the Morrill County Planning Director. I've served in this post for about 17 years now, and we've done some land partitions in Morrill County for utility facilities necessary. We have a couple of them outside of Ione for water tower and outside of Irrigan here where my office is for a wastewater treatment facility. But in 2017, we thought we were doing good work when we adopted the model code that was developed by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I believe we were doing good work. But when UEC came forward with the request to partition, it was like, absolutely, we can do that. And then when we started getting into how the model code impacted our allowances, it became clear we really didn't have that authority. And when we started digging into statute and rule, statute's clear and rule isn't quite the same as statute. And so this is really kind of an attempt, I think, to figure out how to allow utility facilities necessary. This is not for utility facilities that are commercial in nature. This is truly for those utility facilities for public use or utility facilities necessary. So water towers, wastewater treatment facilities, substations. And for us, the substation in question was really about supporting our farming community. It was about needing power to move water, to get to be able to service a number of farms, increase the irrigated footprint here in both Umatilla and Morrow County. So as local government, you know, we try to do what we can to best serve our community, and that includes our utility providers. And this is, I think, a pretty simple cleanup to allow this activity to happen. Again, as Alec had shared, we worked good, I think really well, with both Farm Bureau and Thousand Friends. The language that we incorporated is from some of you who have been around a while and remember the mill bill from a while back. We drew from that the limitation on how we can use this land division going forward in the future. It cannot we can't use this to allow further changes in use on farmland. So it really is about protecting farmland, but more importantly, I think it's about protecting those farm uses. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but I do appreciate your time today, and I do appreciate your consideration of Senate Bill 408. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? I'm still looking at this dash two and trying to understand the difference between more than and at least, but I have the letter, so just get that processed. Okay. Any further questions for this group? All right.
Thank you.
Let me close the public hearing on Senate Bill 408A, and that's it for today. And colleagues, we have no committee on Thursday. 25th. We have no committee on Tuesday. The next Tuesday. And I'm trying to consolidate people who were scattered all around into one more day. Until we see if we get any other bills, and maybe I'll fit them all in on that one day. So, anything else for the good of the order? Okay, adjourned. Oh, what? Representative Brock Smith. Representative David Brock Smith, the South Coast, wants to talk.
I've appreciated working with you and the committee members during this process. So, always enjoy.
Are you fishing for an invite to the committee party?
I'm always fishing for an invite to a committee party. So, no.
Have a tearful goodbye at our final informational hearing on channel meandering. Thank you, Representative Rocksmith. We certainly have appreciated your, 82 bills that have been in this committee alone, and 195 that are still alive in one chamber or the other, and 462 total introduced. And with that, we'll adjourn the committee.